Hi, welcome to Root Canal Academy, where the ultimate goal is root canal mastery. Welcome to the four quarters of the root canal game, and we're going to go over the total root canal playbook. And in the pregame, okay, this course is modeled after a football game. And there's four quarters to a football game. There's a pregame, a halftime, a post-game, and even a press conference. And in each phase, I'm going to discuss something that is related to the root canal technique. We're going to go through the four quarters of the root canal game. And in the pregame portion, we're going to talk about diagnosis, getting an accurate diagnosis, and case selection. Which cases should you attempt to do a root canal, and which ones should you refer out? In the first quarter, we're going to talk about anesthesia, getting complete anesthesia on those hot mandibular molars, and rubber dam. How do you place a rubber dam? When do you use a rubber dam? Always. The answer is always. And how do you place it? What clamps are the best clamps to use? In the second quarter of the root canal game, by far the most important quarter of the procedure, we're going to discuss access, coronal negotiation, open orifice or coronal flare, negotiation to patency, okay, patency going out a half millimeter out the frame and into the periapical tissue, accurate working length, open glide path. That's the second quarter, the most important quarter of the root canal game. Then at halftime, we're going to discuss Zen Endo and correct Nitai selection. Then in the third quarter, we're going to talk about Nitai shaping, which to me is probably the most fun quarter of the root canal game, actually shaping the root canal systems with your Nitai rotary or reciprocation files. And then in the fourth quarter, we are going to talk about filling or obturating the cleaned root canal system, either with a warm vertical condensation, with guttacore, or with single cone hydraulic condensation using BC sealer. So those are the three obturation techniques we're going to discuss. In this Root Canal Academy, the course goal is to make you better tomorrow. And I hope after listening to one or two segments of this course that you have a root canal the next day in your office, and I hope and pray that you are better tomorrow for it. In this course, we're going to talk about a C-cubed practice, which means character, confidence, and competence. I assume you probably all have a C-cube type practice where you have integrity, you do the right thing, you have the confidence in your technique, and you have competence in your technique. A C-cubed practice will lead to E-cubed endodontics, which is effective in your technique, in your endodontic technique, efficient in your endodontic technique, and most importantly, excellent in your endodontic technique. And that is what this course is about, to teach you E-cubed endodontics, to teach you to be effective, efficient, and more importantly, excellent when you do your root canals. Now, we are going to talk about pregame. Okay, so first up in pregame is the favorite diagnosis. Okay, in your pregame, you have to get an accurate diagnosis as 50% of the cure. In the second part of the pregame, we're going to talk about case selection. Now, in diagnosis, if you can go back to your dental school, do you remember the SOAP format for the diagnosis? The SOAP, SOAP format. I know a lot of people don't remember this format, but this is an excellent format to use when you're diagnosing a tooth or a quadrant and trying to figure out what is going on. So the first thing of SOAP, SOAP, is the subjective complaint or the chief complaint of the patient, all right? And this is what is the patient complaining about? What is hurting the tooth? And you simply, it's just the statement by the patient, their chief complaint of why they've come into your office and what's hurting the tooth. Secondly, in the SOAP format, there's the objective portion, and that is the radiographs that we take and our clinical testing, okay? Then the assessment in the SOAP format, S is subjective, O is objective, A is assessment. That is taking the subjective part and the patient's chief complaint and the objective part, our clinical findings and radiographic findings, putting those two together and coming up with an assessment, or better known as a diagnosis. Lastly, in the SOAP, S-O-A-P is plan. What is the plan or the treatment plan? Okay, and this is the SOAP format. And just kind of an overview of the SOAP format. Now let's get into the first part of the SOAP, the subjective part, okay? This part's important. When the patient comes in, they have a chief complaint, ask the appropriate questions and listen to their response. I typically have my assistant do this part now. My assistants are trained to ask the appropriate questions and then they will take notes. So when I walk in, I've already have the subjective part is done for the most part. I may add more to it. They already know the chief complaint. My assistants already have their chief complaint and all the other issues and things that hurt the tooth. They've already taken radiographs, a straight radiograph and an angled radiograph, a PA. And that's up on the screen. So I'm able to get right into the subjective part, ask them some questions and listen to their answers, and then get into the objective part also. In the subjective part, you want to ask them specifically, are you having cold pain or hot pain? Do you have biting pain on that tooth or teeth? Do you have throbbing pain? Okay. Does the tooth just ache by itself when you're doing nothing? You're watching TV or driving in the car. Also, I like to ask the patient, how long, if you're having cold pain, does the pain linger? You know, I like to, and I ask, or I have my assistant ask all the appropriate questions. How long have you had the pain? Is it getting worse? Are you chewing on the other side and avoiding the tooth? Which tooth is it? I love when the patient points to the tooth. I want the patient to own the tooth. In fact, sometimes when I find the right tooth, let's say it's tooth number 3 and I percuss it, and they jump kind of out of the chair, but 2 and 4 are fine. I will sometimes percuss it again gently and say, that's the tooth, right? And they say, yes, that's the one. I like it when they own it, when they own the pain and they own the tooth, that this is the tooth that's going to need treatment. So when you're dealing with your subjective, you want to ask every question that comes to mind, especially in those diagnoses that are a little more difficult. You can ask, do you have, if it's an upper molar, have you had sinus infections, chronic sinus infections? Do you, if it's a lower molar, or what kind of do you have referred pain? Does the pain refer back to the ear like the lower molars do? Does it refer up to the temple like the upper molars do? Or does it refer to the side of the nose like the upper premolars and canines and lateral incisor will do sometimes? Just sometimes you can get a pain pattern from the referral pattern. So just ask the questions about hot, cold, biting, throbbing. Have you had a recent restoration? Again, are you avoiding that side? Are you taking meds? Are you taking Advil for the pain? How bad is the pain? 1 out of 10. So just think of, there's a ton of good questions. If you look at the book, I've written this out in great detail just to go through some of the questions you want to ask the patient and cover. On the, that's the S part, subjective. On the objective part, again, that's our testing. And first we start with radiographs, and we want to take a straight periapical, then a 45-degree angled periapical, and then a bite wing if there's any interproximal caries. If it's something tricky, if there's a lesion or there's something weird going on, I will take a CBCT, okay, a cone beam computed tomography, so I can get a three-dimensional view. It's not a bad idea to take a CBCT whenever you're in doubt of something tricky or something funny going on, take a cone beam, okay, if you have it. Then you want to proceed to your clinical testing. And the clinical testing is basically I start with the mirror and the periodontal probe. The first thing I do is, let's say it's number 3 that the patient's complaining to. I have the patient complain to the, or point to the tooth, and I will test the entire quadrant. I'll test number 2, number 3, number 4, and number 5. So I have a mirror and my periodontal probe in my hand. First thing I want to do is check out the tissue. I look at the tissue, the buccal, gingiva, mucosa. I look at the palatal tissue. Just make sure to look for any sinus tracts, any swelling, anything, any lesions, anything out of the ordinary. Then I will go to the teeth, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. I will look for any restorations, fractures, decay. You know all this, basically anything that's out of the ordinary. Then I will go right to percussion. I'll take the back end of the periodontal probe. If the patient's pointing to 3, okay, sometimes they don't know, but let's say they're pointing to tooth number 3, I will start away from tooth 3. I'll start with tooth number 2. I'll percuss tooth 2 first. Then I may skip 3 and go to 4 and then to 5, and I'll percuss, and just each cusp tip I'm percussing medium level of percussion, not too hard, not too light. And I'll say, does that hurt? Does that hurt? Or tell me when you have pain. What I'll do is I'll start again with the presumed innocent tooth, and then to the symptomatic tooth I may go the second or third time, because I want to see how jumpy this patient is. So if I'm starting on 2 and that's a normal tooth and they're jumping, then I know that they're probably very sensitive. So I have to be careful not to get any false positives. Okay, so I start with 2, they're fine. Then 3, I hit mesial buccal cusp, and I feel it, it's pretty sore. So then I will put down either percussion 1+, 2+, or 3+. Obviously, this is very subjective on our part, but if it's very sore, I put down a 3+, medium sore, 2+, just barely sore, a 1+. If it's not sore at all, I put down W and L on my notes, okay? Next, after percussion, I flip the mirror around, the back end of the mirror, and I check mobility of number 2, number 3, number 4, number 5, number 6. I'll check mobility with the two ends of the mirror and the periodontal probe. Then I'll flip both of them around, and I'll do a probing depth, all 6 spots on all of the quadrant, on the upper right quadrant, okay? Once I'm done with that, I will put the periodontal probe down. I will put my finger in to the buccal vestibule, and I will palpate apically 2, 3, 4, 5 to see if I get any palpation pain at the apical portion. Usually, not often, but I do get that sometimes. If I do get apical palpation, I try to note which tooth I'm on, what root I'm on. Once I'm done with apical palpation, I pick up a bite stick. Okay, I have the 2 different bite sticks. I have the normal 2 sleuth, the white bite stick, and then I have the blue one that's a little more pointed and smaller. But I will place the bite stick again. I'll start with number 2 or number 4, a presumed innocent tooth. I'll put the bite stick on every cusp tip, and I'll have them bite down. And I'll even, when they bite down, put a little bit of torque on that area. And I tell them, if you feel any pain, let me know right away, because I go fast. And I don't like it if they go, yeah, I felt some pain about 5 bites ago. So you want them to tell you right away when you do the bite stick, okay? After the bite stick, put the bite stick down. So I've done pretty much everything so far except for one thing. And sometimes this is the most important assessment piece. And that's endo-ice. The last thing you want to do during your clinical testing is endo-ice. Don't do endo-ice first, because I think it kind of freezes the nerve a little bit and you get some weird readings on your clinical testing. Wait till the very end to do endo-ice. I spray the endo-ice on a medium-sized cotton pellet, not a Q-tip. A Q-tip has the fibers are too tightly bound and cannot carry the cold as long as a medium-sized cotton pellet. Spray it on a cotton pellet and place it on the buccal of number 2 or number 4 first. Number 2, get a reading, get a baseline reading of presumed normal tooth. We're not sure, it might be 2, you never know. and find out, okay, what kind of patient does this patient have? Delayed sensitivity on cold on all the teeth, so it's a normal delayed W&L, or do they have, severe cold sensitivity, or do they have normal on two, and then three, patient jumps out of the chair, and then they have a lingering 15-second ache. So I will put three pluses with lingering on next to cold endo ice. Okay. One thing I want you to keep in mind when you're testing with endo ice, sometimes the upper bicuspids don't always respond to cold. Okay. I have to be honest with you. I don't know why. And I'm sure there's a reason, and I need to ask some people that are much smarter than me and find out why. And you may already know the answer, so let me know if you do. The upper bicuspids do not always respond to cold, so be careful on those ones, okay? You might think it's necrotic, and it's a normal pulp with just a resorbed apex or calcified, calcified or resorbed pulp chamber, okay? Once you've done all the testing, you put the testing with your radiograph assessment together to form a diagnosis or the assessment of the tooth. S is subjective, O is objective, A is assessment, P is plan. Let's go back to the objective part, the radiographs. When you're reading the radiographs, you want to look at each tooth, and you want to look first at the bone all around in the area. See if you see anything, any irregular bone patterns of the trabeculae. You're looking for any type of lesions, any radiolucencies. Then what I'll do is I'll like to follow the PDL. Okay, you can start with the PDL and then go to the bone. I like to do the bone, and then I kind of narrow down to the periodontal ligament of each tooth. I want to look and follow the PDL around all the roots. Make sure it's intact, it's not widened, and look for the different variations there. It's not always perfect that you can see the entire root and then the PDL, but different, a straight and a shift, a lot of times you can catch most of it. You want to read your radiographs. You want to then get an assessment or a diagnosis. When you do your tooth diagnosis, every tooth that you do treatment on, an endodontic treatment, has to have a pulpal diagnosis, an inside the tooth diagnosis, and a periapical diagnosis or an outside the tooth diagnosis. It's also called periridicular or periapical diagnosis, outside the tooth diagnosis, the tissue outside the tooth. So you have to have a pulpal diagnosis and a periapical diagnosis if you ever get sued and it's from root canal treatment gone wrong, the lawyer is going to ask you, number one, did you use a rubber dam? And number two, what is your diagnosis for that tooth? So it's very important that you have a pulpal diagnosis and a periapical diagnosis. Let's go through quickly just what the different pulpal diagnoses that are out there. This is from this American Association of Endodontics. They have fairly new guidelines, I think from 2007 or 8 or 9. They came up with new assessment, new diagnosis guidelines. They're very simple. It's really, really well done. With a pulpal diagnosis, you're either going to get normal pulp, reversible pulpitis, which is after you do a restoration, the tooth is sensitive to cold for 2 weeks, maybe three. That's reversible pulpitis. Pulpitis is just inflammation of the pulp or the nerve. Then you have irreversible pulpitis - symptomatic or irreversible pulpitis - asymptomatic, which would be caries into the nerve, but they don't have pain. Okay, that would be irreversible pulpitis. Asymptomatic. Most of the time, you're going to get irreversible pulpitis -symptomatic. The nerve is alive, the pulp is vital and alive, but it's inflamed and it hurts the patient. They have pain to cold, and that's probably the number one, or heat. Then you have also another pulpal diagnosis would be pulp necrosis. It would be a dead nerve. Okay, so the two most common diagnoses for pulpal that I put down in my practice are irreversible pulpitis -symptomatic. It's an inflamed live nerve, and it responds very sensitive to cold. And pulp necrosis, which is a dead nerve, and it does not respond to cold at all. That's why endo ice is so important to do at the very end and to get a good reading from endo ice, because that sometimes will give you the answer. Continuing with our pulpal diagnosis, there's also something called previously treated. That's just prior root canal treatment. So your pulpal diagnosis is previously treated. If you get a case where the root canal was started by another dentist but not finished, you would put the pulpal diagnosis previously initiated therapy. Previously initiated therapy. That would be like a pulpotomy or a pulpectomy. And there's calcium hydroxide in there, but the root canal is not finished. That would be what pulpal diagnosis would be, previously initiated therapy. Now, talking about the apical diagnosis or the periapical diagnosis or the periridicular diagnosis, this is the outside the tooth diagnosis. And the pulpal diagnosis is inside the tooth diagnosis. So now you're talking about the periapical diagnosis, outside the tooth diagnosis. It could be normal apical tissues, okay? And you can have an IP, irreversible pulpitis symptomatic pulpal diagnosis, and you can have a normal apical tissue periapical diagnosis. In that case, they would have only, they'd have pain to cold, but no pain to percussion and no pain to biting and no palpation pain. So you would just put normal apical tissues as your periapical diagnosis, but it would be IP symptomatic for your pulpal, and that would require a root canal treatment. Continuing with the periapical diagnosis, the next one, and the most common one I put, is symptomatic apical periodontitis. Symptomatic apical periodontitis. And this is with if there's a lesion present or not. Okay, so a PARL plus or PARL negative. PARL stands for periapical radiolucency. Is there a lesion, a radiolucency present? Yes or no, it doesn't matter. But if they're sensitive, if they're percussion sensitive or bite stick sensitive, then you put down symptomatic apical periodontitis because the periapical tissue is inflamed. Apically, the apical tissue, periapical tissue is inflamed. It's symptomatic apical periodontitis, and you know that by your percussion or bite stick, and that hurts them. Another periapical diagnosis you can put down is asymptomatic apical periodontitis, and this is, there's a PARL present, a radiolucency present, but the patient has absolutely no pain, no percussion pain, no bite stick pain, but the damn lesion's there. And then you're trying to talk the patient, telling the patient they have active infection, that you have to do root canal on this, or you could get a flare-up, it could blow up. And it usually blows up the first day on the cruise to Mexico, you know? So, but these are the hard cases. You got to talk the patient into the root canal treatment because of the lesion, but they have no pain. And then you're going to do the root canal treatment and cause pain, most likely, okay? Then you're continuing with the periapical diagnosis. You also have acute apical abscess. Acute apical abscess, and that's just swelling. Anytime you see any kind of buccal swelling, any swelling, acute apical abscess. The next one is chronic apical abscess. A chronic apical abscess is just a sinus tract. Most of the time, the sinus tract's drained to the buccal. If you see a sinus tract, that means there's been a long-standing infection. It's chronic, and it's worked its way out through the path of least resistance, usually out the buccal cortical plate, and is draining. A sinus tract means the patient generally doesn't have very little pain because the infection is draining. It's not building up in the bone and causing pain. It's actually draining out the sinus tract on the buccal parietal. Okay, so that's the apical or the periapical diagnosis. Review that in the book. Review that on the website, the page, the one page AAE guidelines for pulpal and periapical diagnosis. My thought is print it out and put it up in your office on a board so that when you're doing your diagnoses, you can refer to it. I actually did this. It took me a few months to change to the new type of guidelines that they put out. So it's a very smart, though. It's a very good guidelines, and it's really well thought out. So give it a chance. If you're an older dentist, you may go off different diagnoses, but it's time to get on the right one. Lastly, you've done your diagnosis, and now you've got to do this last part of SOAP. So subjective, objective assessment, the diagnosis, and then P is the plan. What are you going to do? Root canal treatment, or if you're unsure, you're not sure, is it number two, is it number three? I can't tell. I didn't get a good reading. You can do a wait and watch. Okay, wait and watch. bring the patient back in 2 weeks, 2 to 4 weeks, or if the symptoms localize to a certain tooth, or if the symptoms get worse. And that's what I tell the patient, and I leave it up to the patient. Call us in two to four weeks, and if the tooth's really hurting, come in, and we'll test it, and we'll be able to figure out what tooth it is, okay? Now, penalty, 15-yard penalty is diagnosing the wrong tooth and doing the root canal on the wrong tooth. I showed a case in the lecture, in the video lecture, where a dentist diagnosed the wrong tooth and started the root canal, had trouble locating one of the canals, asked me to complete the root canal. When the patient came in, he said, "You know, doc, I'm still having cold pain. I still have the same cold pain I had back when we started this root canal. Is this today is going to take care of that cold pain?" And the answer is no. That is not going to happen. It was a misdiagnosis. It was not tooth 19. It was actually tooth 18, needed a root canal. And so we have to be careful when we diagnose. We want to make sure we get an accurate diagnosis. Now, timeout. Calling a timeout here in the root canal game, root canal football game. How do we talk to our patients? Okay, how do we talk to our patients when they need a root canal? Well, the best way I found is to use a tooth model that shows a root canal, and I have a tooth model where the teeth are split in half, and you can see the pulp, the nerve of the tooth, and it just shows in sequence how you do a root canal. And it takes me 30 seconds to show the patient visually, and you got to show them visually what a root canal is. It's much better than explaining it verbally. And I can show them 30 seconds, and I tell them, you see this tooth? This red part's the nerve. We're going to take it out, which is the next section of the tooth. We're going to take this part out, and then we're going to put a filling in there. See this root filling? And I show them on the model, and they say, "Oh, yes, yes, I see it." And then my last thing I say is, you see this crown or this filling? You have to get a crown or a filling on this tooth once we're done. So it just shows, it tells everything to the patient, and they can see it visually, because a lot of people are visual learners, so it's important that we don't just do auditory learning. Okay, now part two of our pregame is case selection. So we just talked about an accurate diagnosis. Now we are into case selection. In other words, should I do this tooth? Should I complete the root canal or start the root canal on this tooth? Or should I refer it out to the local endodontist? The point is, the bottom line is, if you're in doubt, refer it out. Okay, when in doubt, refer it out. On case selection, here are some guidelines that I think you should think about. Calcified teeth. If you take an x-ray and it's really calcified inside, the nerve is calcified, you may want to think about referring it out. Long roots or roots with extreme curvature, large lesions, those are possibilities that you would think about referring patients out. A patient with curvy roots is going to be much more difficult to negotiate and to shape safely. A long roots, when you have a 31-millimeter canal, can be much more difficult to clean completely and to obturate and get a cone to fit to length. So you have to be careful there on the long cases, long roots. Large lesions can be a problem, because a lot of times they don't always heal, and they may need an apicoectomy or surgery. So sometimes those cases are better handled by the endodontist, because if your root canal fails, then the patient can't blame you. Now it needs a surgery. He didn't do it right. Although in those cases, if you do want to treat those cases with large lesions, tell the patient, hey, there's a chance, about a 20% chance, you may need a surgery on this tooth to scoop out the infection. I tell them sometimes the infection becomes a cyst, and the only way to remove it is you have to scoop it out with a spoon. And that's kind of the way I describe the surgeries. Another part of case selection is pain in the butt patients. Patients that just are terrible patients. They're patients that you just would never want to treat again, or you do a filling on them and they're horrible. Refer that to the endodontist. No reason doing those patients and causing you stress and heartache. Patients with limited opening. If it's a second molar and they have limited opening, forget about it. you're going to struggle and struggle and struggle. In fact, heck, the endodontist is going to struggle. So if it's a limited opening patient, get it out of your office, have the endodontist do the root canal treatment. How about cases with uncommon anatomy? You get these cases that are just crazy curves. There's anastomoses. You have a lower bicuspid that bifurcates, the canal bifurcates in the apical third, or an upper three-canal bicuspid, or five canals and an upper molar, just anything with uncommon anatomy. It's just sometimes it's going to cause you more heartache and you want to refer that out. Now, sometimes you don't know. You just don't know that a tooth has uncommon anatomy until you get in there and start treating it. And then you realize, I'm way over my head. I am way over my head on this one. And the best advice I have for you is stop, place calcium hydroxide, and tell the patient, hey, this is a tough one. I'm going to refer you to the endodontist to complete this. And then you just have to charge the patient appropriately. You cannot charge a root canal fee because the endodontist is going to charge the root canal fee or root canal code on the insurance. So you can't charge a root canal code. You have to charge either palliative treatment or emergency treatment or something. You guys probably know that better than I do. But some general dentists will actually charge the insurance root canal code. And then when we finish the root canal, they've already charged the root canal code and the patient has to pay out of pocket or we have to call the dentist and deal with that. So be careful on that. How about kids? Can you handle kids? Can you do root canals on kids? Well, if a kid, some of the kids I treat, the 12-year-olds, are actually better than the adults. In fact, most of the kids I treat are better than the adults. They behave better. But some kids are very difficult behaviorally to manage. And kids are hard. They don't have, sometimes the frame and the apex is open. They have an open apex. Those are difficult cases to handle endodontically. So you get a case, a trauma case, or a case with a lesion with an open apex, refer that out to the endodontist unless you are very brave. Those are tough cases. Not saying you guys can't handle that or gals, but when in doubt, refer it out, okay? And just showed a lot of my cases in the lecture, in the video portion of a lot of some very difficult cases, calcified cases, teeth that kind of merge in the apical roots that sort of merge together. Showed long curvy roots and just difficult cases. So be smart about that. When in doubt, refer it out. If you're new to endo, try to focus on more of the incisors, maybe the bicuspids too. The bicuspids can be a little bit tricky also, but just focus on the more anterior teeth for a while until you're comfortable. Now let's talk about Coach's Corner. And let's talk about patient management. I want to give you some tips on patient management, how you handle these patients. The first thing you do when you know the patient needs a root canal, tell the patient, root canals take about an hour plus, an hour to an hour and a half. That's what I tell all my patients. This root canal is going to take about an hour to an hour and a half. I'm resetting their expectations. Okay, they sometimes will expect the root canal to take 10 minutes. So I'm resetting everything. Now they understand they're going to be here a while. They better put on their Zen mind and chill and go to their happy place because they're going to be going the next hour to an hour and a half having a root canal in this tooth. I also tell the patient, this may take two visits to complete, okay? I get some patients, I go, oh, man, bummer. I don't want to come back. I tell them, look, sometimes it's just a difficult treatment, and I don't know till I get in there, but I would plan on this possibility of two visits. I just want that put that in their mind, so if it does need two visits, I have a get-out-of-jail-free card, and I'm able to bring them back, and they don't throw too much of a hissy fit. When in doubt, do two-visit treatment, okay? Don't rush and hurry and do crappy one-visit treatment. That is something I've learned and learned and learned over the years, and I continue to make that mistake at times, and I tell myself, dang it, I should have just done two visits. The root canal treatment would have turned out so much better, and the patient probably in the end would have been happier, okay? So sometimes what I tell the patient when I do two visits is I said, look, I need to clean the infection and place an antibacterial medicine for the inside of the tooth and an antibiotic for the outside bone to help continue to kill the infection. So basically what I tell them is, like, I need to place an antibacterial medicine inside the tooth to kill the infection, and then I'm going to give you an antibiotic to kill the infection on the outside. Okay, and that's why we have to do it in two visits. So I try to make it simple, although that didn't seem that simple when I discussed it. All right, that is the pregame. That is pregame, and I hope that that was helpful in getting a diagnosis, an accurate diagnosis, and learning what is in the case selection. What teeth do I want to tackle, and what teeth do I want to refer to the endodontist? Thank you.